will examine the ramifications of 13 additional charges against former President Donald Trump.
A Fulton County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment.
Plus, the dire circumstances for civilians in Afghanistan as the Taliban marked 2 years of ruling over the country.
Pretty dismal, I would say. The Taliban has reneged on almost all the assurances or promises they
made.
And
the military junta in Niger continues to cling to power, while West African army chiefs determine their next course of action. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. After a grand jury in the U.S. state of Georgia indicted former President Donald Trump and 18 others in connection with efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss, some experts say the nature of the latest charges will give Trump's co-defendants an added incentive to testify against him. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Many Americans stayed up late Monday night to see and hear Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis detail the charges in a 97-page indictment against former President Donald Trump and 18 others.
A Fulton County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment, charging 19 individuals with violations of Georgia law arising from a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in this state.
Willis gave Trump and the other defendants until noon on Friday, August 25th, to turn themselves in to the court. One expert told VOA that because Willis got indictments on racketeering or RICO charges, all 19 charged will be linked together as one group. Anthony Michael Kreis is an assistant law professor at Georgia State University. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
And that, in many ways, is not great if you're at the top of that food chain in some respects, because it gives an incentive for people to provide evidence and to make deals to your detriment.
For his part, former President Donald Trump blasted the indictments on social media, proclaiming his innocence and describing D.A. Willis as out of control and very corrupt. Trump said he would hold a news conference Monday to present a report on what he termed the presidential election fraud that he says took place in Georgia. Some 60 court rulings in multiple states found Trump's claims of election fraud in the 2020 presidential election lacked standing or merit. Trump remains the clear frontrunner in the race for the Republican nomination for the 2024 presidential election, with other candidates reluctant to call him out for denying that Biden won in 2020. One expert tells VOA, this denial of the 2020 election results is truly unprecedented. Larry Sabato is a veteran political analyst with the University of Virginia. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
And the problem here, as in all societies, is once you break down a barrier and set a precedent, no matter how bad the precedent is, it's so much easier to have it done again and again and again. And that's Donald Trump's real legacy to American democracy. He has weakened it and undermined it.
One voter at the Iowa State Fair told VOA he was going to await the verdicts before judging Trump. Rick Stewart is a libertarian voter from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
But I do know this, until he's been judged guilty by a jury of his peers, he's innocent. That's America.
Trump is seeking to delay the trials until after the November 2024 elections. Willis is seeking a trial in Georgia within the next 6 months. Trump is also facing trials in New York, Washington, and Florida. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
With his mounting legal problems, Trump could be spending more days in courtrooms than on the campaign trail. To find out how the charges in Georgia could have more serious consequences for the former president, I spoke with VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman.
Yes, Kim, it's a bit of deja vu every time we have one of the indictments. We hear similar lines from both the prosecutors and from Republicans, especially Trump supporters. What's different about this case is it is in a state, and it is not a federal matter, the state of Georgia. And this is quite an expansive case centering on the alleged behavior of the former president and his 18 co-defendants in the 2020 election in the state of Georgia. Now, what is going to happen in the immediate future is we are going to see again the former president voluntarily surrendering to authorities and going through a booking process. And the former president will be fingerprinted and a mugshot taken, presumably, which may or may not be released to the public. But officials, including the sheriff of Fulton County, Georgia, are saying that Trump will not receive any special treatment. And most people, when they're arrested in this county, are taken to the main jail, which is just northwest of downtown Atlanta. And it'll be very different than the more, shall we put it, antiseptic federal buildings that the president has been used to going through these surrender processes at.
So this is going to be quite a different indictment and case than the others there that he has against him. And Trump has also lashed out at investigators even before this indictment was handed down. And he wasted no time in responding, denouncing the indictment itself as election interference intended to hurt him as he runs in the 2024 presidential race. He also re-raised arguments he made in the aftermath of the other three indictments, saying that they show a double standard of the justice system specifically targeting him. So does he have a valid argument given other U.S. candidates who have lost elections have said the election was stolen from them?
Well, but former candidates who have lost elections have not reacted the way that Donald Trump did. And according to prosecutors, they certainly did not engage in the type of criminal behavior that Trump is accused of here. Essentially, he's being compared to a boss of an organized crime group. These are the types of charges, racketeering under what's known as the RICO Act, that are usually associated with mafia bosses, not politicians. And these 19 defendants, including Trump, are accused of conspiring to subvert the 2020 presidential election in what the grand jury sweeping 41-count indictment calls a criminal enterprise. So most certainly the president has a right to his defense. And as prosecutors will point out, everybody that is charged is presumed innocent until they go through the process, which may or may not result in a conviction. But what Trump has already been warned about by a judge in another case is that these public comments he's making, which Trump defends as free speech, as First Amendment rights, can be viewed, and some prosecutors are viewing them, as attempts to tamper with witnesses and intimidate people that might be called to testify against him. So he potentially could face some more legal action, depending on what he says about these particular cases.
Yes, that's interesting. And he's also done a good job, as you mentioned earlier, of framing his legal woes, facilitating his supporters to buy into his premise of two-tiered targeted justice. So is this why, though, that he is still the front runner?
Well, every time he's been charged, it has not hurt his case among his supporters. It has bolstered his support in polls, at least among Republicans. And in most of the key early states, You're seeing Trump capturing up to 50%, and no other candidate in some of these states is even in double digits. So he has a resounding lead. These legal troubles are not likely to hurt him among the core Republican base, but where they appear to be causing concern for those in the Trump campaign are among independent voters who in one or two or both of the past elections voted for Donald Trump. And more of them seem, at least they're telling pollsters, they may be inclined to vote for somebody else in the Republican primary or in the general election than Donald Trump because of all these legal troubles he's facing. And a lot of people in the Republican mainstream acknowledge this is a huge distraction, not only for Trump's campaign, but for all Republican campaigns. And we have a debate coming up, which I'll be in Milwaukee for next week, and we'll probably hear more, whether Donald Trump is on the stage or not, at that debate about Donald Trump than Joe Biden, who should be the collective target of the Republicans running for president.
Yes, you brought up some really good points, Steve. And it also just leads right into my next question, and that's the historic indictments against Trump pose grave legal risk to him and have unpredictable political consequences as he seeks to return to the White House. You talked about the other Republican candidates. How are they going to weave through this complex web as they campaign to become the primary presidential candidate?
As I pointed out in some of the stories that I've been doing on VOA, some of these Republican candidates appear that they're really not running for president. They're running for a vice president. Maybe they want a position in a Trump cabinet if the president is able to win a non-consecutive second term. So some of them are very supportive of Trump or trying to say they're a better, cleaner version of Trump without all the legal issues. But you do have a few candidates, a former congressman from Texas, Will Hurd, and a former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, who are definitely campaigning on an anti-Trump platform and saying very bluntly that if Republicans want to win the presidency next year, they need to nominate somebody else than Donald Trump. And, you know, this is a very serious and unprecedented situation. We have a former president who is now facing a total of 91 charges across four indictments. He's pleaded not guilty to every one of these felony counts, and as you said, is repeatedly denied wrongdoing, calling it a witch hunt. And the Georgia indictment is the latest. It's the fourth in 5 months, and the second that relates to his alleged role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
That was VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis. Afghanistan's Taliban marked the second anniversary of their return to power this week, celebrating their takeover of Kabul and the establishment of what they said was security throughout the country under an Islamic system. The Taliban say Afghanistan is now enjoying a peaceful time not seen in decades, but for many women and girls who enjoyed extensive rights and freedoms for two decades, their plight has become dire since the return of the Taliban. For more insight on life in Afghanistan today, I spoke with Bruce Hoffman, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. I asked him how life has changed for Afghans living under the new Taliban government.
Pretty dismal, I would say. The Taliban has reneged on almost all the assurances or promises they made during the Doha negotiations. Women have been disenfranchised. They've been barred from attending school. They've been prevented from really working or having their own lives. But I think that's only part of the story. The persecution of religious minorities in Afghanistan, the Hazaras in particular, has continued. And I would say far from delivering security, Afghanistan is one of the centers of burgeoning insurgency and terrorist campaign by the Islamic State that was defeated in Syria and Iraq in 2018 and 2019, but has not only gained a foothold in Afghanistan, but has proven enormously challenging for the Taliban authorities to suppress, much less defeat.
The Taliban says that the corruption has reduced as Western money poured in for years after the Taliban were ousted in 2001. Is this true that there is less corruption there now?
The corruption now is all orchestrated and for the benefit of the Taliban. I think that's the only difference. Certainly the Akhani network and the Akhani family benefits from its positions of power and close relationship with the Taliban. There still is narcotics production. I don't think the situation has improved for the average Afghan to any significant extent.
Just wanted to go back to talking about the plight of the women and girls in Afghanistan. They, for the past two decades, had enjoyed extensive rights and freedoms under the Western-backed government's rule. Now, their plight has become dire, as you say, since the return of this new Taliban regime. Could you give some examples of how women and girls' lives have been changed by the new Taliban government?
I hear this personally from my students and from Afghans who were able to flee about the situations that their families, and particularly the female members of their families, continue to endure in Afghanistan, where they're prevented from working, and therefore families that especially have widowed women or children without a father, for instance, are in complete penury. I mean, they have no way of earning an income, no way of putting food on the table. You know, unfortunately, it's a completely tragic circumstance where 2 years later, there are still people in Afghanistan suffering tremendously and reaching out to the West, to the United States, to any countries, countries in the Middle East, surrounding countries in South Asia, for help, for an escape, basically, from a life mired in poverty with no earning potential, with no equality, and with no educational opportunities.
And what is the relationship now between the U.S. and Afghanistan?
It continues to be estranged. I think that there have been some forlorn hopes that the commonality of an enemy in the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL or Daesh, as it's known, might have led to some kind of modus vivendi. But frankly, I think the discovery of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the former leader of al-Qaeda, living very comfortably and safely, at least he thought so, in Kabul, in a villa that was closely associated with the ruling Taliban regime, pretty much obliterated the desire, or the not the desire, pretty much obliterated the practicality of any kind of security cooperation, because once again, it was shown that the Taliban had lied to the United States or was not prepared to carry out commitments it had made during the Doha negotiations.
Yes, and the Taliban is now saying that they want recognition for the progress that they say they have made, and they want the lifting of sanctions and the release of about $7 billion in central bank assets that is frozen in the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and it was frozen back in 2021, half of which was later transferred to a Swiss trust. So will the Taliban, will they get the recognition that they want?
That's difficult to say. I don't think so, because like any authoritarian, totalitarian regime, they have their own narrative and they live in their own parallel universe where they believe their own falsehoods. As I've said, they have not fulfilled the commitments they made as part of the Doha agreement. They have returned to form rather than being a new, any kind of reform Taliban. They have reverted to form and operate precisely as they did in the 1990s. So I don't think that any progress in the short term will be forthcoming of recognizing the Taliban as legitimate rulers of Afghanistan or indeed in freeing those funds.
That was Bruce Hoffman, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. 3 weeks into the coup in Niger, the military junta continues to cling to power, while West African army chiefs hold a second day of talks in Ghana to determine whether their next course of action is diplomacy or a military intervention. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo reports on the choices confronting Africa's regional leaders.
West African defense ministers held a second day of talks on Friday in Ghana's capital, Accra, where they're mapping out a possible military intervention if diplomacy fails to reinstate Niger's deposed president, Mohamed Bazoum. Reda Liamouri, an analyst who has done a lot of fieldwork in the Sahel Lake Chad Basin, says the West African bloc ECOWAS is in a difficult position, trying to discourage coups in the region, but grappling with whether diplomacy or military intervention is the best deterrent.
At the moment, there are still some divisions in terms of the military intervention, not only between the ECOWAS and the African Union, but also among the ECOWAS members, as well as, of course, the position of regional members that are excluded from these meetings, who are currently run by junta, by military regimes like Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea.
Liamouri, also a senior fellow at the Policy Center New South, a Moroccan-based policy research firm in Washington, told VOA, a military intervention could not only be catastrophic to Niger, but also to other countries in the already volatile region. And he says it could spill over beyond the Sahel.
I think North African countries do have a role to play in terms of their diplomatic efforts to try to play the peacemaker, bring everyone to the table to find the solution that is going to be less damaging to the region, because North Africa would be concerned if there is a military intervention because of borders, Algeria specifically, but also there are a lot of economic and diplomatic ties between North Africa and Niger and West Africa in general. Morocco has a lot of economic interests with Niger itself. We know in terms of like food security, the renovation and remodeling of the capital Niamey efforts, in addition to other businesses like in terms of telecom, insurance, banking, etc.
Emira Woods is the executive director of the Green Leadership Trust and also a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She applauds the recent efforts by regional religious leaders who visited Niamey.
We had an incredible engagement of faith leaders coming from the region to Niger, stepping forward to say war is not the answer, to say diplomacy must be first and foremost to find a path to the democratic process.
Wood says it's time for African unity and directly points the finger at the West.
What we have before us is an incredible juxtaposition of international community with its interest and focus on resources, particularly the uranium that's in Niger, building up military forces, training, equipping those military forces.
Most Western countries have condemned the coup and have thrown their support behind efforts by the African Union and the ECOWAS bloc. Niger holds strategic economic and geopolitical significance internationally. Uranium and oil, two natural resources plentiful in Niger, are sought after in the international commodities market. And under President Bazoum, the country was a big ally to the West in the fight against insurgency groups in the region linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group. Junta leaders have justified toppling the democratically elected president because they accused him of not handling rampant insecurity in some parts of the country. On Wednesday, 17 of its soldiers were killed in an ambush by insurgents about 60 kilometers from the Niger capital, Niamey, in an area that borders Burkina Faso.
What we have is an undermining of peace and security in the region that goes back to the NATO invasion and the ouster of Gaddafi in Libya, and the flow of weapons into Libya, then from Libya throughout the region in the Sahel. What we have is a steady equipping of military actors and making it literally laying the groundwork for these military actors to gain power, strength, visibility, and legitimacy in a way that has emboldened them to launch coups from Mali to Burkina to now Niger. And of course, you have a similar situation on the other side of the Sahel in the Sudan region.
Sudan's two rival generals have been engaged in a brutal war against each other the past 4 months, with no end in sight. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Kim Lewis.